Okay, we're back on tape. Right. Were you finished with why it was unique here? Or?
No, I think that's really, you know, in terms of, you know, my interest. I just feel that one of the other reasons I want to be in a medical school is just to be, really, I wanted to be immersed in, among the biologists and sort of, you know, I find it's just much more stimulating to be immersed in biologists. One of the things, the year I spent at Yale, which was a wonderful working environment for structural biology and biophysics, in a funny way, the community was too big, and it's a real powerhouse. But in a funny way, the community was too big, and it became a kind of isolated little island where people simply talked among themselves in terms of structure and methodology, and I didn't feel there was as much potentially, and partly it's probably because I was really doing methodology there, but I could see that there wasn't as much interaction with the sort of biology community, and I'd rather be sort of the way we are, where we're just kind of thrown and sprinkled among all these great biologists. It's just much more interesting and stimulating for me, and that was another reason I actually wanted to be in a medical school, or at least a biology department versus a chemistry department. And in fact, when I interviewed at Berkeley, it was actually in a chemistry department. That was another reason I didn't want to, aside from the teaching load, which would have been horrific. But it was really intellectually, I just didn't want to be with those guys versus the biologists. That's certainly part of it. But that's not unique to Stanford. I mean, that's just anywhere I would have wanted that.
Well, we talked about ethnicity in terms of the students. And in terms of the graduate students, how does the male-female breakdown look?
It's pretty good. I'd say the pool... I don't have the statistics in front of me, obviously, but there are a lot of women in biomedical sciences applying and in graduate school. In fact, strangely enough, right now my lab has 2 men and 9 women.
Oh, really?
For example, it varies, and I think that's a good thing. I think obviously we all know that there's an enormous discrepancy at the level of tenured faculty, which is partly a historical thing, because that, of course, is predicated 10 years back. Hopefully that will change. Here it's certainly, the faculty is certainly predominantly male, and I think that's, I'm sure, a bad thing for the female graduate students in terms of role models, but, you know, that's something that just has to improve slowly over time. I mean, you know, hopefully more and more women will really steep into the system. I don't see women leaving the system because of it, but, you know, that's just from a very limited, you know, I've only been, you know, 7 years is not a long time to see that kind of long-term trend. And certainly I have a number of female friends from graduate school who are, you know, on great faculties elsewhere, and but it is true that in our field, which is more physically oriented, of course, we all know that there are, you know, girls in, starting in junior high school, I think, tend to drop off from the physical sciences more. For, you know, somewhat known reasons. And so, you know, that does lessen the pool of students we see there. But we actually have a surprisingly, I don't even remember this year, I think our prospective students we've invited for interviews in biophysics this year has got to be close to half women. So I think that's a great thing. You know, in a funny way, I guess when someone asks me, I'll think about it, but it's never an issue. I mean, we just look for really good students, and we've been lucky. I mean, we've had, I've certainly had terrific graduate students, you know, male and female. So,
well, pretty much everyone that I ask this question to says that, you know, the women are represented roughly equally. With the men at the graduate level and at the postdoc level, but clearly not at the at the faculty level. And, you know, you suggested that that might be historical, that it's going to take some time to catch up, but have you ever been on a faculty search committee? And what, are there as many women applicants?
Definitely not. The two I've actually chaired were one in our department and then one in at the synchrotron because I'm on the faculty there. Mm-hmm. That was a funny position though up there. But and again, that I think partly is that that was a very physics kind of thing, and there really aren't as many women in the physical sciences, you know, mm-hmm. the quantitative sciences. That's just a fact. In our department as well, because it was physical. Although we certainly had some very strong women who applied and we interviewed. In fact, it turned out we did hire a man in the end, which turned out to be a partly. He was a kind of unique situation, and it was someone we brought in at an associate professor level, not an assistant, because we really needed to establish an MR here, and the school, I don't think, would have gone for giving the millions of dollars it required to set up an 800 megahertz magnet for someone who wasn't already established to some extent. Mm-hmm. So I think it was unusual. So when we had a search, we had some very strong female applicants, I would say. In fact, I would say in our final list, I don't remember the breakdown, but it was... Mm-hmm. It wasn't 50-50, but it wasn't far off. I couldn't tell you the numbers off the top. So that's very encouraging. But I also know it's true, and I mean, you know, there's all the, you know, the pressures of, you know, a lot of women want to have a family, and of course, the system is not geared to giving time off and having the time period on a day-to-day basis to do it. Now, I think it depends when I've seen it work. For example, my friend Pamela Bjorkman, who's another Pew mm-hmm. scholar who's down at Caltech, and her husband Kai Zinn, you know, they're both on the faculty there, and they've had two kids since they've been down there, and you know, the school was great. They sort of, I think, if I remember right, they gave Pamela an extra year in terms of her tenure, and mm-hmm. Kai as well, so they could spend more time. And so I think if the schools are, you know, can be accommodating, it's great. But there are a lot of things that are beyond the capacity of the school. I mean, you know, there's just time constraints. You've got to get stuff done for your grants that are, you know, the NIH grants doesn't mm-hmm. give, grant system doesn't give you time to go off and be on maternity or paternity leave. I mean,
they don't care if your kid had an
They couldn't care
class,
less.
Right?
They couldn't care less, and that's a genuine problem. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, even with the best, you know, kind of marriage where people are, you know, really sharing the work 50-50, there's still a lot of work to be shared. You know, and I think it goes for men and women. Mm-hmm. Of course, we know it's obviously biased against women. You know, mm-hmm. we all know that's true, and that's a really tough issue. Mm-hmm. Because the system is not set up to be to help out, mm-hmm. and I don't know what you do about that, to be honest. And mm-hmm. I'm sure that's a major discouragement for women. Not being a woman and not having kids. I can't speak to any personal experience, but you know, I know that that's an issue. Mm-hmm. And you know, the women who do succeed, obviously, I think have a much you know, who actually do have families and the like, really are tough. And I mean, you know, they have a much tougher road to go, I think. Mm-hmm. And it's, but you know, in many departments here, there are a fair number of women in some of the departments here, and you know, they're obviously doing well. So, mm-hmm.
Does Stanford give people extra time on their tenure?
You know, I actually don't know.
You don't know.
I don't know what the policy is. It wasn't an issue for me, so.
I was surprised interviewing one scholar to find out that Harvard does.
Uh-huh.
But there's also a difference between giving someone time and then in subtle ways, you know, punishing them for taking the time.
I think there are a lot of subtle things that go on. But even, as I said, beyond that, mm-hmm. I think there's just so much of the fundraising and the external pressures, even if they give you teaching relief. I mean, there are a lot of things that schools can do that are positive and they should do. But nonetheless, it's hard. I mean, I don't know how one solves that, actually. Mm-hmm. I really don't. And I think it does take an extra level of commitment mm-hmm. in that regard. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the thing is, and I've heard it, you know, I have heard it from senior colleagues, you know, that I think there is still... in this day and age surprises me, but I think there still is bias against women. I really do believe that. I've heard it, you know, from people. Mm-hmm. Not everyone, you know, obviously, but
sure.
but I've heard it.
Well, there was that thing at MIT just a couple years ago.
That's right.
Okay. Well, let's, now that we've talked about teaching. Let's go back to the other things that take up your time. You mentioned grant writing.
Yeah.
And it sounds like, you know, you were, in the beginning, you were kind of a little bit lucky to get stuff done. But right now, at this point, because you're probably no longer eligible for all these young investigator things.
Yeah, unfortunately.
How much time do you spend in trying to get money?
It goes up and down. I mean, 2 years ago, I spent a lot. Basically, right now I have 3 R01 grants from the NIH.
3? Wow.
Yeah.
And, that's a lot.
And basically, I had this one from the work, which is still ongoing, and I've just renewed it, and, you know, it's fine, on the work I started as a postdoc. Mm-hmm. And then when I came here, I got 2 other things going that I really had wanted to work on. And that was totally dependent, basically, on the Pew. And a little later on, the Howard Hughes Institute gave Stanford a pot of money to give sort of 2-year grants to junior faculty. So it wasn't a direct thing from Hughes's. They just gave Stanford money, and then they said, okay. So I had this junior faculty scholars program you could apply for. And those 2 things allowed me to get other stuff off the ground, the Pew being the first one and probably the more critical one, actually. And it was actually quite interesting. I'll show you how important this stuff is, because I wrote one of the Young Investigator Awards, actually. Yeah, I wrote to the Pew and also the NYI, this is the NSF-sponsored National Young Investigator Award. And my sense, and I may be totally wrong, I thought that was less competitive than the Pew. I may be wrong about that. I just don't know. But I wrote to those 2. And the same proposal, okay? The Pew said, great, this is really interesting, because I think the Pew kind of awards partly on more on track record, and I figured all these young investigator things do. The NYI came back basically like a peer-reviewed NIH grant saying, well, there's no reason, you know, you have no they have no reason to think, you haven't shown us any preliminary data yet, and even though you're a wonderful guy, you know, there's no, it's not clear you could even do this. And I thought that was the whole idea of these young investigator awards. So I was shocked to get this thing back. And then and then at the same time, I had a postdoc who was coming. I was very fortunate to get a really good postdoc from Pamela Bjorkman's lab, who wanted to work on this problem. So he wrote to various the usual suspects of the post, you know, the cancer agencies for postdocs, and he got a very prestigious one. He got the Jane Coffin Child. Mm-hmm. He wrote to American Cancer Society, which is not as competitive, and he got the same review saying, "Well, there's no reason to think you can do this." So, you know, so I immediately knew that seeing that there's no way I was going to get an NIH grant, because this is the kind of peer review you're going to get. So the Pew is absolutely critical for doing that. But we got it going, and we actually got it to go successfully, and you know, which I knew we were going to be able to do actually. And then once we had it going to the point I could write an NIH grant, you know, I wrote one and I got it.
Sure.
Okay,
sure.
But it was that kind of thing. And this is, so I guess because of the Pew, I ultimately didn't suffer on that project, because I knew that, you know, it did exactly what it was supposed to do. Okay, the Pew and then this Howard Hughes thing. And then, and that got funded for a shot once we had enough. So I already had 2, you know, was rolling along with that. And then the other project we work on this, which is involved in intracellular vesicle trafficking, was a very interesting case, because that again got going. I collaborate with a Hughes investigator, so he helped out with some, you know, technician basically. Mm-hmm. And then I, you know, I try to get my own money for it, and I spent a lot of money from the Pew and this Howard Hughes thing on that. And finally, I felt we had enough preliminary data. Certainly, at the point I had written the Katinin grant to go to the NIH, so I wrote an NIH grant, and I got a very low score. Basically, it was a completely, in my opinion, flawed review, because basically they said, one project's great, the other one you don't have enough data for. So what they're supposed to do then is cut out the money for that sub-project and give you the money for the rest, because they didn't have any scientific criticisms. Instead, they just gave the whole grant a low score. So I felt this is kind of ridiculous. So I said, well, okay, easy enough to rebut. I've now lost 9 months, because you have to go through the cycle.
Sure.
But fine. You know, I wasn't too panic, so I write the thing, I cut out the project, I send it back. There was nothing to respond to. Get the review back, same low score, and now they're complaining that we wanted to see more stuff. And that is basically illegal as far as I'm concerned, because you're supposed to and a resubmission and respond. So then I called up someone at the NIH, you know, and I called up someone I knew on council, and I said, well, what do I do? I said, well, this is, I won't name the study section, but this was just, the study section's a disaster. It's well known in our community to be a disaster. So I talked to my colleague, Richard Scheller, who's my collaborator, and said, look, just send it to a different institute because this is obviously hopeless. So I did that, and then it got funded. Okay. So with that, so that was a very, you know, and I know, you know, this is not unique. Okay. Mm-hmm. All of us have had this. And I was lucky because I already had two other grants. I mean, imagine someone going through this, and I have had lots of friends who've gone through this with
it's their
first grant.
Yeah.
You know, so I've been pretty fortunate, and I, you know, I understand that I have been. But it just shows how important this kind of unrestricted money really is, because you just run into this nonsense. And the thing is, you know, Harold Varmus, you know, and all the reforms he's trying to do, terrific, you know, and they want them to look more at, you know, track record and innovation and stuff. But fundamentally, the people reviewing these are conservative, you know. Mm-hmm. They're going to look at, you know, they're conservative, and that's mm-hmm. part of the problem. Mm-hmm. I don't know what was going on with that grant. I mean, it was odd. I mean, the whole thing with that was just, and I actually in part blame whoever was the administrator at that time, because I think that administrator said, no, this is just a blatantly unfair review, mm-hmm. You know, to do that, and they don't do it. Mm-hmm. So I think there are just a lot of flaws in the system, and mm-hmm. you know, I'd be much more up in arms, but obviously I've done well by the system. So, but, you know, I can really sympathize with the frustration of many of my colleagues. You know, I have colleagues, junior faculty colleagues here who I've tried to help out, you know, reading their grants. But, you know, you just run into these peer reviews and you don't know what to make of them. Mm-hmm. And I think the system does break down. Of course, you always think if your grant doesn't get funded, oh, they're all a bunch of idiots, you know. And that's of course, not true either. But I think in a case like this, I thought, mm-hmm. I just thought it was really flawed at a very basic level, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of being really unfair, mm-hmm. given the way the whole thing turned over. Mm-hmm. So I think that actually set us back in the sense that I had to spend time reworking these grants three times. Mm-hmm. You know, and ultimately the grant that got funded was fundamentally no different. It really wasn't fundamentally different mm-hmm. from the one I had submitted twice. Mm-hmm. So that's very frustrating. And in fact, that was the project we actually got scooped on. And I think, and I really do attribute that in part to, not completely, but in part to the time I couldn't spend working on this stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, I basically was wasting my time writing the same grant three times, mm-hmm. and that's very frustrating. Mm-hmm. So, that happened. And we also, and then another project I've been trying to do, which is a very high-risk thing, we've submitted a couple of times and to programs that were said, oh, yeah, we know that, you know, we don't expect you to be that far along because this is very high-risk. This is crystallizing a membrane protein, which is a very, very high-risk thing. NIH has a special program to sort of fund work in this area. And, you know, my collaborator and I submitted a grant, and it got turned down. So, you know, even though they say they're doing this, it still seems rather conservative. Mm-hmm. So that's a real frustration to waste time on stuff like that when mm-hmm. you'd be much better off just being able to mm-hmm. do stuff. And, you know, and then what's happened is that with the in our field particularly, you know, those of us who support NIH are competing against these labs funded by HHMI, which are fundamentally unrestricted in this sense, and they don't spend their time dealing with this. And that playing field is very non-level, and I think that's true of other fields as well, but it's certainly true in ours. And that's created, they're terrific people funded by that, of course, but, you know, the reality is that it does create a rather unlevel playing field when you have to run into these buzzsaws at the NIH and mm-hmm. having to spend a lot of time rewriting mm-hmm. what are fundamentally pretty reasonable grants. Mm-hmm. So those kinds of things in the time, I actually don't mind writing grants, unlike I think a lot of people. I actually don't mind. I think there's nothing wrong with having to articulate and justify what you're doing. And I feel I can do that pretty well, and I've been successful at it. So that aspect of it I don't mind, but when you run into this kind of thing mm-hmm. Is when it really does get very frustrating, and you see yourself not spending time doing what you're supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, on balance, you know, I've done well by it, but I certainly have been, I've had my share of frustrations with it at the same time.
Yeah.
You know.
Has there ever been a time when you thought you might not be able to keep things going financially? I mean, three grants is more comfortable than one grant,
sure,
for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, actually, you know, there's never enough. I mean, our continuing grant is not a big grant, and I hope when I renew it I can get more money for it because, you know, we only had sort of one thing really working, and I just couldn't ask for a lot at that mm-hmm. time. And in fact, you know, they cut. They said, "Well, you're not far enough along in this other thing to fund mm-hmm. another postdoc." And you know, I'm chronically short of money on that, but I've managed. I never worried about the whole lab collapsing. I've certainly worried about not being able to pay people from time to time. But I've been very conservative. If people want to, you know, write to me about doing postdocs, I just say, "Look, I can't do this right now because I want to know if someone comes here. I don't want to have to stay up at night worrying about whether they can eat." You know, basically. And even if I think that there's a good chance they'll get their own money, you know, I won't do it. Or I'll say, "Look, I can guarantee it for 1 year. You have to get your own money, and if you're willing to come under the circumstances, great, but I won't hold it against you if you decide not to come because you don't want to take that risk." So I've been kind of risk averse that way. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I can sleep at night. Mm-hmm. And the reality is, with the Pew and the HHMI Junior Scholars Award combined with the first NIH grant, until I got that second one, I was never really so worried about it. I always had that a fair bit of unrestricted money, and I was very careful about spending my startup money as well, which I still have a little bit left over of, actually, just for a rainy day. Mm-hmm. So I've been very conservative about managing the money because I don't want to get in that situation. Mm-hmm. I've never really worried about it collapsing. I mean, from time to time, but never in a kind of prolonged way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. What about, you sort of, we glanced over some of the administrative responsibilities. It sounds like you had relatively few at the beginning, but
no,
I'm told these things tend to snowball.
Yeah.
What kinds of administrative responsibilities do you have, and how much time do they take up?
Yeah. So the only thing I really had administratively before was graduate admissions, which we were joint with the biochemistry department, so they actually ran it. I just sort mm-hmm. of had to read some applications. It's no big chore. And I've been involved almost since day one. I was asked to serve on the biophysics executive committee, which is basically a glorified admissions committee. So I was always involved with that. And what happened is that over the years, that was actually run by the chemistry department, by Steve Boxer in the chemistry department. And chemistry is a very different culture from biomedical sciences. They just admit students. They have hordes of students come in. They flunk a number of them out after the qualifying exams. I mean, certainly at Berkeley, you know, they do that. I don't know how Stanford works. And they support them for a couple of years by teaching. We don't do any of that. Okay, so we have a much smaller pool of students. We actually interview them beforehand. We actively recruit them. Because it's a small pool of these very good students. And we spent a lot more effort at it. And what basically I did over the years is got biophysics kind of drawn into the culture of the biomedical side. And it was very successful, actually. We've been actually one of the most successful programs in all the biomedical sciences and recruiting over the last couple of years. And so Steve decided to, he'd been running it for 12 years and he was sick of dealing with the training grant stuff, so he asked me, you know, I was asked to take it over, and I agreed to do it. So I'm now running that graduate program, mm-hmm. which has turned out to be a little bit more work than I anticipated. And I'm going to have to write the training grant renewal for it, which was going to be a big chore. Particularly that we have some real deficiencies, as I mentioned, in terms of minority recruitment, which I'm trying to figure out how to deal with now. So that takes a fair bit of time. And as a percentage of total time, it's not that big, but it's constant little interruptions. Students writing to you,
yeah.
you know, from overseas or, you know, wanting to know more. You have to respond, and just little things like that. Mm-hmm. And I'm lousy at time management, so I found it to be a bit annoying. And, you know, uh-huh. It's just a skill I'm going to have to learn to do better, I think. On the plus side, I am praying it will immunize me. It gives me moral authority to say no much more. when I'm asked to do other things. So okay. I think that's good. And you know, I pray I will never have to, you know, do chairman of the department or anything like that. I think this is a far less onerous task. So that's all good. And if I can keep it just to that, that's fine. I haven't been asked to do study section work yet. I'm sure that day will come, which I'm dreading. I think I would not do it while running the biophysics program. I would just ask to defer that until I stop doing that, because I don't think I can do both of those. And that's pretty much it, though, in terms of administrative stuff. It'll, you know, the rest of it's the lab itself and just making sure we're not overspending our grants, which, you know, we get help with our business manager. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I do manage to spend... I would ideally like to be able to spend 90% of my time doing research. It's not that high, but it's also not 50. It's somewhere between 50 and 90. I don't know what the number is. I think that's pretty good considering.
Yeah, I should say.
Yeah, that's the way I want it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the way I want it. But largely it's because of the teaching. Mm-hmm. In the fall when I teach more, you know, I have a very concentrated period of teaching in the fall quarter, and that's kind of it. And that quarter is kind of taken up doing that. Mm-hmm. And then around this time of year with the biophysics admissions is a lot of work. But aside from those two times, it's really pretty good. Mm-hmm. And I really try not to travel too much. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing. I did it once a couple of years ago after we saw beta catenin, which was kind of a big thing. And I had a fair number of seminar invitations and like. And I, in fact, I was told at my third year review by one of my colleagues that, you know, the one thing you really should do is travel more. Mm-hmm. Which I hate doing because I just don't. I find it very disruptive. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the one sort of mentorship thing that they, you know, I had. You know, so, well, you probably, you know, for your tenure, you should probably just have a few more things in your CV in terms of admissions. I never, in terms of invitations and stuff, and I just never really cared about that. But I said, okay, fine. You know, so I did it, and I found it incredibly disruptive. So I learned my lesson because I counted 10 or 11 trips that year. Which is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. You know, being away, you know, once a month, being away for a couple of days is really a lot in terms of just disrupting the flow of the work. So since then, I just really avoid it as much as I can. Mm-hmm. And I'm much happier.
Do you mind the speaking? Or
no,
no,
actually, I actually enjoy giving seminars and, you know, talk about the work. Visiting... generally, I don't mind and like, and I like, you know, conferences. If it's a good conference, it's great, but it's so disruptive, you know, so it's just this balance. And, you know, it's a tricky thing. You don't want to be a hermit because it's, I'm never really very concerned about my reputation in the end, but I recognize that, you know, you want to publicize the work enough that you can continue to get a stream of postdocs applying for positions and stuff like that. I mean, it is unfortunately part of the game, not one I actually relish, but, you know, it's a reality. I accept that. But I really like to minimize it as much as I can.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Now, what about writing for publication?
Yeah, that I actually like.
You do?
Yeah, I do. Again, the only thing I don't like about it is the time pressures. And right now, it's a funny thing to say, right now has been kind of a not-so-enjoyable writing period because we have too much success. We sort of had this string of things that, you know, we're just getting our, you know, I'm getting the fourth out of what will be 8 papers out the door. You know, it just got 3 major things out the door. And the time pressures, and one of them we were trying to write, and it was a very important paper, and it was while I was teaching and stuff, and that was really hard because actually I really do like writing. But so generally I do like it, though, and I feel I write reasonably well. I can do it reasonably efficiently if I have nothing else to do. That's a big problem with time management, though, because when I get distracted, it's very hard. Mm-hmm. But the downside, one of the things that's been difficult is the transition from a postdoc to a PI. Is writing, you know, it's other people's papers, and I want to teach them how to write, and some people are good at it and some are not, even though they think they are. And that can be very frustrating with, you know, major arguments about papers, and it's kind of a joke in the lab that, you know, when you're writing a paper with me, you know, the best thing is to break into my office and hide all my red pens. But you know, I think it's just really important, and I am very fussy about it. And I had a recent paper with one very good but very obstinate graduate student, which was extremely painful to write for both sides, I think. Mm-hmm. But in the end, I said, look, this is just stuff we've got to do. And it came out. I'm not as happy with that paper as our other ones, but it's fine. Mm-hmm. And the work's really good, you know, so...
So they write the papers and you...
They do a draft, mm-hmm. yeah. And I find it much harder to write that way than writing it myself from mm-hmm. scratch, mm-hmm. of course.
Sure.
Styles are different, but even with that, though, I do take a lot of satisfaction out of pointing out how to reorganize this to make it more clearly and say, you know, these are wasted words, these are wasted sentences, you know, it's getting, the flow's getting lost. And when they come around to it that, you know, how to really put it together, it's great. And my first graduate student, who was a fantastic guy, actually, his first paper was kind of all over the place. And then, you know, we worked on it, and our collaborator worked on it as well. The next three papers he wrote, I almost had to do nothing. You know, he really got the message, you know, and it was mm-hmm. great. And you just see that kind of improvement, mm-hmm. you feel like you've done something. Mm-hmm. So that was great, and I really like that, because I think that's something, that's one of the mentorship things I think we are really, truly responsible for, mm-hmm. because, you know, most of the students here, you know, they know how to do research. Mm-hmm. You know, we direct them, whether or not they think so. Mm-hmm. but the writing is something that a lot of them don't know how to do. Mm-hmm. So that's actually something I do spend time on with them, and I very consciously spend time on it with them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is tenure here at the associate or the full professor
associate
level? So you're
I'm tenured. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Was that how was that in terms of stressful or time consuming or
neither? Basically, the honest truth is I really didn't think about it at all until about my fourth year, when, partly because of my sort of the dysfunctional nature of our department at the time, I was supposed to have a third year review and it hadn't been done after my fourth. And, of course, I didn't even keep track. I didn't even know this. So it kind of got done in a very haphazard manner. Mm-hmm. And in the end, there weren't really too many problems. They said you should really try to get some of the stuff written up, because they knew things were progressing. And they actually, even for that, get outside letters. So I guess there were no major red flags at that point. And then the year before that, we had sort of a pretty important paper come out, the cell paper, the beta-catenin paper came out. And I figured, well, that was a fairly major piece of work. And we had the science paper on this phasing methodology. Mm-hmm. And then I knew we had this one other thing coming down the pike, and the NSF D2 domain, which is this other cell paper. I don't know if I sent you that one or not.
I don't think so.
Anyway, and that one wound up being, I sort of figured, well, if that one also came out, then, you know, everything's fine. And everyone was telling me there's no problem. So mm-hmm. I had no indication that there was going to be a problem, okay, mm-hmm. from either my external colleagues or people here, I mean, actually. So I really wasn't worried about it. It wasn't even on the radar screen until that point. But then I figured, you know, it would be really good to get this paper out. And this is the one major personnel disaster I had. I had this postdoc who basically didn't do anything, and he tried to get everyone in the lab to do everything for him. And basically, mm-hmm. I basically had to let him go in the end. But I basically had to do the entire project, you know, solve the whole structure myself and write the paper. And I got that out the door. We actually should have had it solved. We actually had the electron density map something like 9 months before we actually got the paper written, because I kept waiting for him to sort of solve it from that point, and mm-hmm. he didn't. And basically, I just had to take over the project and do it. Of course, I was doing a lot of teaching at that point,
sure.
So it really slowed me down. And then I figured, well, you know, this is probably kind of maybe important for the promotion anyway. So I just really got it out there. And at that time, I found, you know, we rushed it out the door, got it out and accepted, and then I knew everything was okay. You know, I figured at that point. And that turned out to be kind of a good thing because, I mean, in fact, our unbeknownst to us, one of our competitors actually had just solved the same structure. So it turned out they came out together, so no one got hurt. But it was, in a funny way, it might well be due to, well, I mean, the reality is we just should have had it out months and months before, you know, which was very annoying. But anyway, I ultimately didn't really worry about it. And then I got asked for materials and all the usual stuff, but it wasn't, all I was asked for was a CV, some reprints. And
you didn't have to do a seminar?
No, here they don't, at least in this department. I guess they do it in a lot of departments, but that wouldn't have been a problem. I mean, anyway, I certainly wouldn't have minded it. In a funny way, it's certainly not meant to be this, but I know it is. There's this thing called Wednesday Club, which originated in the biochemistry department, where we meet for lunch, and now it's our department, them, and developmental biology. And we meet for lunch on Wednesday at noon, and one faculty, gives a research presentation, informal, but, you know, they're pointed questions, and it's, and I participate in this. And so the reality is that there are people looking at your progress, you know, sort of from that funny mechanism. Certainly not meant to be that way. I mean, the senior faculty do it too.
Sure.
But I mean, there is, people do kind of know what's going on. Also, I have some really wonderful collaborations here, so I have some good advocates, you know, in the MCP department, who, in fact, they've now made me a faculty, you know, full faculty member in that department as well. So yeah, it was never really a stressful thing for me.
Okay.
I think a lot of that depends on, obviously, I think people know, you know, how things are going.
Sure.
And what their peers think of them at some level. And unless it's something really pathological in the department, which certainly happens, there are reasons to worry. And there are certainly, the surest sign to me when I interview job candidates, like when we've had faculty searches, people start asking about that. It's a sure sign to me that this is not someone I want to deal with because, you know, there are people who you meet who really are totally obsessed with that from day one, and that's just not healthy. I mean, the only thing you should care about when you're starting out is getting your work done. I think it's always true, but you do find that phenotype, and that scares me.
Yeah. Okay. You said a little while ago that you're not... Your 9-month salary isn't guaranteed here.
Right, that's right.
So, what does tenure mean anyway?
It doesn't mean a lot. Well, tenure doesn't mean a lot in medical schools, frankly. But I think actually, you know, frankly, I don't understand it. I mean, it's the real truth. I do think your salary is ultimately backstopped at some level. It may be 80%. But I guess the way it works here is that you are expected to raise some fraction of your salary from grants or whatever outside sources, and that number is actually a moving target from year to year as the medical school income goes up and down. Actually, it's been very different, you know, than the time I've been here. And I don't know if there are any formal stated rules as to what tenure means in that regard. It certainly means space. I suppose if you lost all your grants and they had to support you for X number of years, they could take your space away as punishment. I'm sure that's true. But I think ultimately your salary is backstopped at some level. But let's put it this way, to have a lab space, a functional group, you are expected to raise whatever fraction of your salary they're telling you. And if you raise more than that, you don't get it back. So actually, I'm raising, I think 90% of my salary is off of my grants at this point, which is higher than I'm supposed to be, than I'm required. But the way they just take it is if you list yourself as some fraction percent effort on a grant and you get the grant, that's what you take.
That's a shame, because otherwise you could spend that extra money on other
people. That's a relatively recent policy change.
Yeah.
It's a way they save money. That's the way they do it. But anyway, it's never been, you know, when I came here, I was, you know, negotiating a startup. I was guaranteed 3 years in case I didn't get a grant, you know, salary. And grant came through after a year. So then, it was fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you said you're really bad at time management. I think under the best circumstances, it would be hard to juggle all of this stuff. But what do you, when you say you're bad at it, what do you mean?
Oh, I just think that if I could go from one thing to another without sort of really, and then back again, writing a paper, without so I'm writing along, then I have to have a 2-hour meeting about a training grant or something, and come right back. I lose the flow,
I see.
That kind of thing. So when I'm teaching, I find it very hard to get much else done. That kind of thing. I find difficult. I'm getting better. It's clearly an acquired skill. At least for me, it is. It's funny though. I mean, there are people. One of my students, she's working on sort of 2 projects. She's fantastic. She can just drop something, do something else, come back, and I really admire that skill. I could never do that, in a lab or anything. It's one of the reasons I know I can't do bench work anymore. It's the same thing. I just don't have that skill.
Well, there was actually, I can't remember where I read this. I mean, I'm sure it was in the lay press somewhere, like Newsweek or something. But a couple of years back, I read something that said that men and women are really different that way. And it's interesting that your graduate student that can do this is a female. But apparently, men are a little more linear in the way they think. And women can do these 52 things at the same time.
Yeah. Well, I guess I could cite myself as an example. What can I say?
It's not it wasn't a scientific study.
Right. Yeah. It's no question. As I said, I mean, that's like, I enjoy writing less now than I used to for that reason, because I love totally immersing myself in writing and really trying to get a coherent thing. It's very hard for me to get my head around a whole paper anymore, because and just spend hours just focused on it, or days when doing nothing else. The only time I have to do that anymore really is when I'm writing grants, because when you're under an absolute deadline, you have to.
Sure.
And, that I can manage. Sure. But even that, I've gotten faster at. I mean, my first grant probably took me 6 weeks to put together, and now I've turned them around in 2 weeks now. I've definitely gotten faster at that.
2 weeks of concentration. How does all? And I know you're not married.
Right.
But how does all this work around having a social life of any
sort? Oh, it's terrible. I mean, I've certainly sacrificed that, not in a conscious way. I mean, it's funny, I'm sure I must be at an unconscious level, but I never consider myself sort of career driven. It's more like I just really, I guess I had goals. Like, I knew I wanted to do this, and I wanted to be in a good place with good colleagues, because I know I'm just one of these people who gets much more out of, I need the constant stimulation of people who are smarter than me, basically. And I think I was ambitious in that sense to be in a place like this where I could really, I definitely take much more out of the place than I give back, I suspect, in that sense. But so I've always worked hard, but it's never been with that goal in mind. It's just been because I really want to do the work. And I definitely am a workaholic, I guess, in that sense. And it's definitely had an impact in terms of relationships and stuff like that. It's definitely a problem, which I'm 40 now. I probably should work on that a little more. But, I really do think things are slowing down. There was just this huge bolus of work that sort of built up over the last few years, crossing through tenure and all that. And I think once these last papers are out the door, we really are going down. We have a lot of new exciting stuff coming down, but it's not going to be quite at the intensity level and coming all at once that it has been. And that'll be good. And I think I'll hopefully get my life in order, a little bit more in order.
Let me change the tune.